There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings together the best bits of today's show from Sunday, December the 29th. Abu Dhabi has notched up 500,000 e-scooter rides since the summer. The question we're asking, though, is are e-scooters the future of green transportation or just an accident waiting to happen?
YouTube presenter Emily Hartridge was sadly killed when her scooter collided with a lorry in London.
That is Ruth Langsford on ITV's This Morning, talking earlier this year about the death of an online star, a social media star, on an e-scooter.
We have got a Twitter poll, and it's been split down the middle, to be honest, for most of the day. I can give you a quick update. Just the optimists have it. The specific question is this: are e-scooters the future of green transportation or just an accident waiting to happen? 56% say yes, they are the future of green transportation. 44% say no, they are an accident in waiting. I have changed my mind. When I came in this morning at 6 o'clock and when I voted, I clicked on accident in waiting. I was quite negative about scooters, but I have been convinced that yes, there are risks, but that actually those risks are acceptable risks, and that's a thing in transportation, acceptable risks. And they are, if we can nail the infrastructure and the regulations and the logistics, the future of green transportation. You've convinced me, Brandy Scott. Just you, to be fair.
Well, this is it, right? I don't understand. And it's actually the same with electric cars and autonomous cars as well. I understand that you don't want any deaths and you don't want any accidents, but the amount of coverage that a death in an autonomous car gets as opposed to the hundreds of thousands of automobile accidents and people who lose their lives in them every year is disproportionate. And we expect our new modes of transport to have an absolutely zero rate of accident and problems. And I feel like that's just not realistic. I mean, ideally, yes, zero would be the absolute aim. But you're not, as long as human beings are involved in any way or shape or form, including designing the technology, the roads and everything else, you are never, ever going to have an accident-free way of transportation. You're just not.
Globally, around the world, according to the Association for Safe International Road Transportation, they calculate the number of deaths through cars every year. Globally, it's 1.25 million, 1.25 million. And we're okay with that as a society. It sounds horrible and harsh to say so, but we have decided that that is an acceptable level of risk to have the transportation benefits that the automobile delivers.
Exactly. And so, I don't know, the whole idea that e-scooters are somehow unsafe when we're perfectly fine with, you know, bicycles and all the rest of it, strikes me as slightly odd. We've been speaking this morning to Vitaly Bielski, who is a senior consultant in the mobility practice at Frost and Sullivan. And we asked him whether they were basically fabulous or dangerous. He was speaking to us this morning, it must be said, from Russia. So the line is a little bit fuzzy, but worth hearing his thoughts regardless. This is Vitaly.
There hasn't been a perfect regulation for scooters across the globe. So many cities are battling the same issue. But I think it's one of the best options when it comes to micromobility, which helps to resolve the last mile connectivity issues. Scooters is probably one of the most efficient way of connecting people, especially the light mile connectivity. And it does need proper regulation. So I think, you know, it has a bright future, but it does require some effort to bring it to the safety standards that we're all used to.
So there you go. Efficient, the way of the future, but we need regulation.
Well, and that's the position that the RTA in Dubai has said. A lot of people talk about e-scooters being banned in the UAE at the moment, but it's under review. There is no total ban on electric scooters in Dubai, but companies have been barred from renting them out, according to the Roads and Transport Authority. The RTA says they're conducting a study to come up with relevant laws, including, they say, possibly the licensing of e-scooters in the way that we license motorcycles. which would be as a form of road transportation.
But then what? Would you have to get a license for them? You'd have to get a license.
And this is what they're looking at. They're looking at licensing. They're looking at whether they should be on the pavements or on the roads. They're looking at what kind of license you need, what kind of protective headgear you have to wear. Musa Al-Raisi, who's the Director of Monitoring Enforcement at the RTA's licensing agency, is quoted as saying you can use your e-scooters in closed areas, or if they are allowed by the Dubai municipality, including in parks and including inside campuses, such as large companies or academic campuses. So it's something that they're looking at. That's the view of Dubai. Essentially, you can't use them on the public pavements and highways.
Does a campus include D3, for example, the design district?
Yeah, I see them used there quite often. Around Dubai
Design
District.
So do I. I just was wondering if it was legal or not.
And you make a valid point. The RTA has been quite clear and said we are still looking at this one. They are conducting investigation into regulations. And as Vitaly said, cities around the world are wrestling with this one. The RTA has taken the view that in public areas, you cannot use them until we have the rules and regulations and infrastructure in place. Abu Dhabi has taken a not completely different view, but a slightly different take on it, in that they have geofenced certain areas of Dubai, including the public pavements and highways, where you can use e-scooters. And one of the companies that's licensed to rent out these e-scooters is Circ. It's a German organisation. They make their own scooters. They do this around Europe and around the world. And we've been speaking to the person who's the co-founder of Circ here in the Middle East and North Africa. To give you some background and context, Jaideep Danoa, who we're going to hear from now, used to be head of strategy at Careem. Mm-hmm. He's ex-McKinsey, so clearly has thought about these things in an awful lot of detail over the past few years, not just happened upon this industry by chance.
Exactly. And we've been speaking to him a lot about safety this morning, because that's the big argument that people make when they make an argument against e-scooters. It is the safety for pedestrians, for the people on the scooters. And so we were having a chat to him about that, and a chat about helmets, asking him, what is the deal with helmets if you are renting one of your scooters?
Currently in Abu Dhabi, they're still forming the regulations, and there's no formal policy around helmet use. We recommend helmets. We recommend minimum age of 18 as well, although it's not required. And the other aspect, though, is, you know, the risk of riding an e-scooter is not, you know, someone is going to drive the scooter so fast that they get hurt badly. The risk is someone driving a car who's not paying attention and hits an e-scooter rider. This is because we don't have adequate infrastructure for e-scooters today, or micro-mobility vehicles today. We don't have enough bicycle lanes, protected bicycle lanes. And we have devoted our city to the car, right? And the car has a monopoly on our roads right now. And that has to change over time.
And we asked Jody what he was actually calling for when he was talking about better infrastructure.
We don't need to address the entire country or the entire city all at once, because the infrastructure isn't conducive all over the city today. Right? Instead, we need to identify the pockets of the city where people can ride safely. Right? And that can be, you know, dedicated bike lanes. It could be broad sidewalks. It could be low traffic, low speed traffic zones, like residential areas where people are not driving frequently and quickly, as long as the rider's feeling safe.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We're talking tax this morning. The OECD is calling for its members to levy a minimum tax on corporations. The UAE is an OECD member. So the obvious question there is, what could this mean for us? We are joined now in the studio by Shiv Mahalingam, who is Deloitte's head of transfer pricing for the MENA region. Shiv, it's lovely to have you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
In layman's terms, for people driving to work before 7 a.m. in the morning, what has the OECD been saying?
Right. So the base erosion through profit shifting project, as you quite rightly mentioned, affects the OECD members, the 36 member states. We also have a wider class called the inclusion framework, which has 135 countries have signed up to this, which include the UAE, of course. And this requires them to adopt a number of minimum standards for international tax to ensure that foreign direct investment can be attracted in a consistent manner to all of those jurisdictions.
Okay. So the OECD has come out this month, and they have said that they want people to do, or their members to do, what?
Right. So if you break it down into pillar one and pillar two, we're talking about businesses that are digital in nature, selling on a digital platform. Unfortunately, the proposals have extended the net to encompass all businesses, unfortunately. So if you take Globe Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 separately, Pillar 1 looks at taxing companies on revenue rather than profit, the traditional measure that we would apply. So really it looks at consumer spend and consumer base, and it's beneficial to those jurisdictions that have large populations. Globe Pillar 2, which came out at the start of the month, as you mentioned, that looks at a number of elements, and I think the thing that is attracting the most interest with business is a potential minimum rate of corporation tax that's being pushed for by the OECD BEPS project.
So every country who's signed up to this agreement, including us, would have to put in minimal corporate tax.
So, yeah, that's kind of it's an important distinction to make. It's not necessary that you bring in a minimum corporation level of tax. Oh, sorry, minimum rate of corporation tax. But if a territory doesn't bring that in, that business operating in that territory could be taxed up to that percentage in other jurisdictions.
Okay, so it's not a case that the UAE would have to start charging corporate tax.
No, that's quite an important point to make as well. Every territory is free to implement its own tax system. The minimum standards that I mentioned are around compliance and regulation. The corporation tax itself, it's not mandatory, but if it's not brought in, then as I mentioned, the US, the Netherlands, the UK, China, India, multinational businesses operating in these territories may be taxed on their UAE profits in these other locations.
Which would presumably include UAE companies operating digitally.
That's correct, yes.
Is there pressure in the OECD for countries to adopt this minimum tax?
Yeah, there's
peer pressure, if you like.
No, absolutely. I think it's important to see a distinction between what is a nominal rate of tax and what is a minimum rate of tax. So we have these regulations which kick in for what we call zero or no or only nominal tax jurisdictions. So anything below, I think, single digit corporation tax or zero corporation tax may fall into that category. And a minimum rate of corporation tax may kick in at around 10% based on what other territories around the world are actually implementing. Now, in terms of peer pressure, really what we're talking about is foreign direct investment. We don't want to dissuade investment into the territory. And that should be the hallmark of any tax policy, to ensure that it doesn't deter investors from bringing business into the territory itself. So that by adopting the international standard, you do have this level of consistency that businesses are aware of. Businesses value certainty. I've been doing this for almost 25 years now, and certainty is the key. You know, if there's going to be a corporation tax, when is it coming in? What rate will it be? So that we can plan for that accordingly.
Yeah. And this is being done basically because of a lot of the outrage, I assume, around the big digital companies that are basing themselves in low tax jurisdictions. Ireland is the one that always springs to mind, or what's being seen as not paying their fair share in a lot of the countries they sell into.
Yeah, it's a complex area. A lot of companies aren't paying tax because they're making losses or they have losses brought forward. There could be a number of different reasons why a company's tax payments are low. But what we're talking about now is transparency. So businesses would need to demonstrate to the media, to tax authorities, to consumers, what their profits are, what their revenues are, how much tax they pay. And that transparency is an important point. You've already seen a number of large multinational entities have started publishing that data already, you know, as best practice and corporate governance to show that they're not doing anything untoward.
Well, I mean, we've been talking about inequality this morning on a personal basis, but certainly it is one that gets people irate, that big corporations seem to pay less in a lot of areas than smaller corporations. What could this mean for the UAE? What are your customers asking you and or your clients asking you, and what are you telling them?
Yeah, so this time last year, we were already, I guess there was already speculation that a corporation tax may be introduced into the UAE, irrespective of the BEPS proposals. It's in Europe and the US, tax collections is around 10 to 15% of GDP, which is a high proportion, whereas it's below 1% in the UAE. Unfortunately, businesses have had to deal with VAT introduction, IFRS, transfer pricing, which is my corner of the world. And now an additional corporation tax rate, obviously there'd be a cash tax hit, but also there's a logistical element to it, administrative, filing the returns, making sure there's compliance on an ongoing basis. So there'd be some administrative elements to navigate. But as I mentioned before, the certainty is key. So if companies, if multinational businesses investing in the UAE, or as you mentioned, domestic groups that are multinational, global outbound, certainty is the key. So if they know that there's going to be this level of corporation tax, they can plan for that in advance.
But the UAE doesn't have to do it. Do you think it's likely at all that it would?
It's a good question. I don't know. If the UAE does not introduce the corporation tax, as I mentioned, businesses will still have to pay it to another territory. So it would seem like a missed opportunity in many respects.
For revenue raising.
Exactly right. But again, I'm not the policy maker, so I can't really take that view.
But it's an interesting trade-off. Do you stay uber competitive with your tax freeness and let someone else collect your tax, or do you take the opportunity to put that money into government coffers?
Yeah, well, a number of jurisdictions such as Singapore, Switzerland, Ireland that you mentioned have attracted investment irrespective of the fact that they have a 10, 12, 15% rate of corporation tax.
Wants to think about there. Shiv Mahalingham, the head of transfer pricing for the MENA region at Deloitte. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Just in case you weren't quite awake this morning.
That is death metal, thrash metal by the Superfly or someone like that. Anyway, the reason we're talking about culture is that a new survey, the Future Brand Index, which measures Dubai's perception among international communities, has given Dubai a really, really good showing when it comes to the creative and cultural industries. These are the findings. 95% of respondents view Dubai as a vibrant creative sector, which is the highest rating in the region. 90% define Dubai as innovative. 89% defined it as creative. And there are various other stats on the brandy.
There are. The one that grabbed me the most was the fact that 82% of the people who asked, and this was commissioned by the Dubai Culture and Arts Authority, 82% of people asked said that they favoured the sort of culture and arts scene here to their home countries. And I thought, just what a turnaround from just 10 years ago, not even, when the sort of number one expat whinge was, there's just no culture.
It really was, wasn't it?
From people, of course, who obviously didn't go home for their holidays and spend the entire week in the National Portrait Gallery. Myself included.
Precisely. To be fair, 10, 15 years ago, the UAE probably didn't shout particularly loudly about either its creative industries or its own recorded culture, whether that's the music or the cuisine or the design or the fashion of this country.
And 10 or 15 years ago, you were watching a performance of The Grapes of Wrath by the BA Travelling Playhouse in the ballroom of the Sheraton. True story.
Right, because there wasn't really a venue.
Because there wasn't a theatre and there wasn't hugely sort of, I mean, there were some small local fringe theatre groups, but in terms of, an actual sort of production that had come from abroad, you were in the ballroom of a hotel.
I mean, if you think back to year zero of the Business Breakfast, which was 2004, mm-hmm. I think, 2004, 2005, there was no Art Dubai. There was no Opera House. There was no Dubai Design District. I'm pretty sure, I haven't checked the records, but there was no Dubai Culture and Arts Authority, which now has Her Highness Sheikha Latifah as the president. So there was so much that wasn't there. Of course, the grassroots culture was there. It's always been there. It goes back decades and centuries. But in terms of packaging it
and selling it to tourists, which is the reason we're interested in the Business Breakfast,
that hadn't necessarily been done. It's about between 5, 7 and 9% of GDP is cultural goods, cultural trade, cultural services, the creative industries. And there are various different definitions. But you're looking at between about 5 and 10% of the global economy, and therefore the UAE economy is in some way rooted to these things. So even if you think, what do I care about this? I'm tuning into the Business Breakfast to learn about the stock markets and what's going to happen to the dollar in 2020. It does matter because they're an important driver of the economy.
Well, I think of them as the sort of the Lonely Planet part of the economy. The amount of things you can fit into your pages on the Lonely Planet Guide to the Middle East, things for people to come and do and see. And that is important in getting tourists out here.
We're asking, what's your favourite hidden cultural gem here in the UAE. The Louvre and Dubai Opera kind of know about it. They've got big marketing budgets, and that's fine. But what about the hidden gem that you think people need to know more about? I've got one for you, because I was up in Hatta this weekend. And right now, the first ever Hatta Cultural Nights is happening. It's an innovation from Dubai culture to showcase the handicrafts, the music, the art that's indigenous not just to the UAE, but to the mountainous region of Hatta in particular. Now, to be fair, I wasn't there for Hatta Cultural Nights. I was there for all the amazing adventure stuff that Miras has put together there. First time I've been up there. It's A, really cool, and B, free. Okay, it's a bit of a drive, but there's some very cool stuff happening up in Hatta at the dam and the Hatta Wadi Hub at the moment. But for me, it would be things like Hatta Cultural Nights, finally shining a light on all the great stuff that's happening there. You've already had it in Al Ain. I've been to some of the workshops that you've got up in Al Ain, where you've got a lot of people making traditional goods and traditional crafts, happening in Hatta as well. So that would be mine. What's yours?
Do you know what? Before I get into mine, actually, I'm going to give Malcolm's.
Because he
was huge on taking people around and showing them the sights, and his favourite photography spot that he reckoned the best view of the creek was opposite Bestakia. When you, if you took an Ebra over, you stopped, you're facing the Spice Souk, slightly to your right, sort of a 15-degree turn, there is a pale pink concrete parking building. And if you take the elevator up to the very, very top and go to the edge that's closest to the creek, you've got an amazing view right down on the dhows, people loading the dhows, the best gear, the creek itself, seagulls, the whole nine yards. And he's right. It is an absolutely fantastic photo. So that would have been Malcolm's. Everyone I've thought of this morning is more about the gift shop than it is about the actual cultural piece attached to it. I have found people making earrings out of carpet-making wool in the Al Seif district. I've gone to the Louvre and accidentally come home with two bottles of perfumes that have been made by an Emirati perfumer, Amna Al-Habtour. But this is important because, you know, you want to go home with sort of local and exciting souvenirs. And I'm very fond of the courtyard, which is in Al Quds, and it's just a tiny little space that's got a couple of art galleries in it. It's got a theatre in it. It's got some great cafes in it. There's great cafes next door to it as well. And it has some really quirky little gift shops that sell local gifts. And they, you know, if you want to buy someone a little bit, something a little bit different, or if you want someone to take home something a little bit different, it's a great place to go. And it's got a really lovely making vibe to it. You go in and there's always people who are doing stuff, filming stuff, making stuff, you know, having sort of group meetings and all the rest of it. It's a nice spot to be.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The people making the headlines today.
And my newsmakers are a bunch of people for whom 2019 has been a very, very good year. The world's billionaires.
I want to be a billionaire so freaking bad.
Are you learning anything about the idle rich?
Yeah, they drive too fast.
Trade places with Miss Tracy Lord for all her wealth and beauty. Just ask me.
All right, I will.
Well, you know, I can't help thinking about it.
I'm a self-made trillionaire. I'm a self-made trillionaire.
Who wants to be a millionaire?
I don't.
Who wants to corner Cartier's too?
I don't.
And I don't. Cause all I want is you.
The world's richest have gained $1.2 trillion in 2019. Their net worth has increased by 25%. This is according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. They've looked at the top 500 billionaires. Perhaps no surprises, global stock markets, particularly Wall Street, have done very, very well in 2019. They are lucky enough to have significant investments in Wall Street, either through the companies they founded, like Jeff Bezos, Amazon, Bill Gates, Microsoft, or just their investment portfolios. But it's been a great year. Number one still, Jeff Bezos, despite the fact that nominally his net worth reduced significantly because of his divorce from Mackenzie Bezos. So that is now split, but still he's top of the tree with $116 billion. Bill Gates, very close second, $113 billion, followed by Bernard Arnault of LVMH, the luxury goods company, and he has been the biggest winner of this year. His net worth has increased by $38 billion to just over $100 billion. Louis Vuitton, the LV in LVMH, he's bought Tiffany's this year, so he's been spending as well as making money, but a cracking year for Bernard Arnault.
It's interesting that that's happening at a time when, you know, the obviously inequality is moving the dial on elections. It's what a number of you know, sort of great thinkers and economists have stood up and said is going to be the biggest issue over the next decade.
Oh, and that has not been lost on a number of commentators. For example, you've got the representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is a self-described socialist in the United States, saying the hoarding of wealth by the few is coming at the cost of people's lives. And that sentiment echoed by a great many people. The many of these billionaires, for example, Bill Gates, have argued and would argue we give the vast majority of our money away through philanthropy. Through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Mark Zuckerberg is now fifth on the list with $80 billion. Again, he and his wife have set up a foundation to give away within their lifetime 99% of their wealth. Not everyone does that, but a great many people do. But that would be one argument from the billionaires. But no question at all, inequality is an issue because the poorest people do not benefit from these rising stock markets. They do not have portfolios. They do not even have ETFs of the MSCI World Index. They get left behind. A footnote, the wealthiest woman on the list is a very new entrant, Julia Fletcher Koch. She inherited $67 billion or $62 billion or thereabouts when her brother David Koch, one half of the industrialists, the Koch brothers, died earlier on this year. So she's the world's wealthiest woman.
Well, maybe not entirely unconnected. My newsmakers this morning are people who might be buying nice things, your Tiffany T bracelet, your Cartier Love bracelet, your Hermes scarf, but they don't necessarily think they deserve them.
I'm an imposter, I know. I'm an imposter, I know. I'm an imposter.
Richard Dean, you've heard of imposter syndrome?
I have, but only in a professional context. For example, I remember my first day walking into the Economist offices in London thinking, I do not belong here. Some lad from Manchester who used to work on the Crewe Chronicle. So I felt it, but this is a different context.
Yeah, the imposter syndrome of which you speak is well documented, and what you've actually described, I suppose, is one of the universal feelings that go with it. Feeling like you're faking it, you're winging it, someone's going to tap you on the shoulder and say, yeah, nice try, Rich. There's the door.
You're going to get found out.
Yeah, we're going to bring someone who's actually qualified to do this. Exactly, that feeling that you will get found out. There is a new syndrome in town, the consumer imposter syndrome. Paper that's just been published in the Journal of Consumer Research. Researchers were led by the Harvard Business Studies doctoral candidate Daphne Gore, have been looking at the phenomena of people who feel not that they're faking it at work, but that they're faking it in life. And when they buy themselves nice things, posh car, nice watch, whatever, they feel like they don't deserve them, that they're just pretending to be the sort of person who would drive a nice car or wear a fancy watch.
And so they just leave them in the drawer.
A lot leave them in the drawer, because I was reading this thinking, well, I mean, that's just a bit ridiculous. You know, who worries about feeling inauthentic and thinking, I'm not the sort of person to be carrying this handbag? And then, yeah, one of the symptoms, if you like, of consumer imposter syndrome is that you don't use the nice stuff that you're buying. You think, well, I'll save that for best. I'll save that for a special occasion. You know, and you never wear the shirts or carry the handbag or whatever it happens to be. And I certainly fall into that situation.
Posh handbag that you bought 3 years ago, or someone bought for you 3 years ago.
Yeah, I literally carried it twice because I think, well, it's a bit too nice to use. And that, apparently, is consumer imposter syndrome.
I know, growing up, it was the dinner service was the big thing in our household. We had acquiring a posh dinner service was a real ambition and goal of my mother. And when she finally did, it never ever saw the light of day because it was far too good to be ever used.
Which is a shame, isn't it? Because then this stuff just doesn't get used. I mean, there's certainly enough memes on Facebook and on Instagram saying, you know, you don't have to wait for a special occasion to wear that dress. Life is the special occasion.
Oh, profound stuff from Brandy Scott. Thanks very much indeed for listening. We're back to our morning live on air with the Business Breakfast. Breakfast from 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.